find that way, we all will say,
Wassa, Wassa Lele.
And welcome to Ecolibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. This is your host, Ryan Young. Welcome to the show. We've got a great show for you today, but we're going to start with some music from Stanley Clarke. And school days are almost over. I know for many elementary school kids and high school kids, this is the last week of school. So school is out at the end of this week. So that's why we're going to play School Days by Stanley Clarke.
Thank you.
And that was the tune School Days by Stanley Clark. You are listening to Ecolibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. Welcome to the show. This is an environmental radio show, and we strive to provide news and commentary about environmental issues, but also freedom of the press issues have also been covered on our show before. And in a major blow to press freedom, the United Kingdom has just recently approved the extradition of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange to the United States to face espionage charges related to the publication of classified documents exposing U.S. war crimes. And I think he exposed a lot more than just U.S. war crimes. And obviously, the United States and many of the Western countries are trying to make an example of him to scare any other journalists from ever doing something similar. So this is not good for press freedom. And so we go to a story from Democracy Now about the extradition of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange to the United States.
UK Home Secretary Priti Patel has approved the extradition of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange to the United States. Assange faces up to 175 years in prison here in the U.S. if convicted of violating the Espionage Act for publishing classified documents exposing U.S. war crimes in Iraq and Afghanistan. WikiLeaks has announced Assange will appeal today's ruling. In a statement, WikiLeaks said, quote, "Julian did nothing wrong. He's committed no crime and is not a criminal. He's a journalist and a publisher, and he's being punished for doing his job," unquote. Just before we went to air today, Assange's wife, Stella Morris, spoke at a news conference addressing today's ruling.
The extradition order rests on a decision to reverse the initial outcome, a decision by the High Court to accept assurances that are severely flawed, that the Amnesty International called that decision a travesty. That is what this extradition order is resting on. We're going to raise points that have come up since the original extradition hearing back in 2020. And crucially, one of the most important developments is the revelation that the CIA plotted to assassinate Julian while he was in the Ecuadorian embassy and kidnap him and rendition him and was exploring poisoning him. This is known to the Home Secretary, but she signed it off anyway, but we will be raising it on appeal.
That's Julian Assange's wife and attorney, Stella Morris. We are now going here in New York City to Gabriel Shipton, filmmaker, Julian Assange's brother. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Gabriel. Can you respond first to the Home Secretary's ruling?
Well, this is, you know, this ruling just says, you know, the UK government agrees that a journalist, a publisher, can be taken from the UK, can be extradited from the UK solely for doing their job. So this is a huge, hugely dangerous precedent that's been set in the UK for journalists and publishers there. So this is just goes to show that this is a once-in-a-lifetime fight for press freedom. And it is inching closer, or, you know, this is coming to the US. The UK government wants Julian extradited. The judiciary has ruled against Julian in favour of the US DOJ to extradite Julian. So I think people can no longer rely on the UK government or the UK judiciary to protect journalism, that people in the USA need to stand up for press freedoms and fight this case.
A group of more than 300 doctors from around the world are calling on Patel to block the extradition. Of course, she chose not to, saying that he suffered a mini stroke last October. His overall health is continuing to deteriorate. They write, "The extradition of a person with such compromised health, moreover, is medically and ethically unacceptable." Can you talk about his condition right now, and will you appeal?
So, yes, that's right. Julian had a mini stroke at the end of October. He has been detained in the UK one way or another for the last 12 years. If you can imagine what that is like, Julian hasn't seen a blade of grass in 12 years. He has been in a maximum security prison for the last 3 years. There's this endless legal snakes and ladders that he has been put through, and it is really, he's a gentle genius, a publisher. He's not a violent criminal. He is not convicted of any crime. He's an innocent man who's been held in prison solely at the request of the US DOJ, and this is really wearing him down. He's been worn down over these 12 years. The UN Special Rapporteur on Torture, Niels Melzer, found that he was suffering the effects of psychological torture. So, it's so sad to see Julian, the Julian that I know from years ago, and the Julian that I've seen in the prison.
And the significance of what it was that he released back in 2010 and has continued to release information over the years, even when he was, in political exile in the Ecuadorian consulate in London.
Yes, that's right. And none of so he's published evidence of war crimes, torture in Guantanamo Bay, government corruption, even the collateral murder video that's world famous. None of these, and it's the publisher that has been punished in this situation. It's none of the criminals, none of the people who have committed these crimes that there is much evidence for. It is the publisher in this situation that is receiving the punishment. The New York Times, Der Spiegel, Washington Post, The Guardian, they all published similar information, and none of them are facing the punishment that Julian is. We are going to fight this ruling by Priti Patel. We have an opportunity to apply to appeal to the High Court in the UK and then to the European Court of Human Rights. So we're going to fight this, but with this ruling, it's saying the UK government, they want to move this forward. They want to extradite Julian to the USA.
Finally, Gabriel, the issue of the United States assuring Britain, if it extradites Julian, he would be able to serve any sentence imposed on him by a U.S. court in Australia. What does this mean, especially given the new administration in Australia, the new prime minister?
Well, that's a treaty obligation that's available to everyone who's convicted in the USA. It sort of means nothing because, by the time Julian gets extradited to the USA, the court proceedings, will be at least 2 years. If he appeals to the Supreme Court, we're looking at an 8 to 10 year process. So, if you add that on to the 12 years he's already been detained, that's 20 years that Julian has had no freedom whatsoever. Three of those years in a maximum security prison. So,
but it is interesting the new Australian Prime Minister has said in the past, Albanese. Can you tell us?
Yes. Yeah, so Anthony Albanese has, in opposition, he said enough is enough in regard to Julian being kept in prison. He said, "I don't see what purpose is served by keeping Julian in prison." That was before the election. Asked after he was elected as Prime Minister if he stood by those statements, and he said, "Foreign policy, not all foreign policy is conducted with a bullhorn." So that is a very significant departure from previous government statements, where they said this is a matter for the UK courts. Julian's receiving consular assistance now. Anthony Albanese has signalled that this is a foreign policy issue. And by saying that it's not foreign policy is not conducted with the bullhorn, it suggests that there are some negotiations happening behind closed doors. So, Julian is very popular in Australia. There was a poll in December, and 70%, it was in a national newspaper, 71% of those polled agreed with the statement that Julian should be brought home. So the new Prime Minister has to represent the will of the people in Australia. And overwhelmingly, people in Australia want this to come to a close.
I want to thank you so much for being with us, Gabriel Shipton, filmmaker and Julian Assange's brother.
And that was a story from Democracy Now! About the recent decision that the United Kingdom took to approve the extradition of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange to the United States to face espionage charges related to the publication of classified documents exposing U.S. war crimes. And this is a major blow to press freedom. We'll be, of course, watching this story closely in the coming weeks. You are listening to Ecolibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. I'm your host, Ryan Young. And the next thing we're going to play on the show today is from Radio EcoShock, which comes out of Co-op Radio in Vancouver, BC. There's a new book out called Generation Dread, Finding Purpose in an Age of Climate Crisis. And that's a book by Dr. Britt Ray. Dr. Ray is a Canadian transplanted to Stanford University and the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, and she is a postdoctoral fellow investigating the mental health consequences of ecological disruption. And of course, many of our listeners may be dealing with those impacts, and some would say today's youth certainly are. I think today's youth are also dealing with an addiction to screens and something that has been termed nature deficit disorder. So the nature is there for many young people to explore, but they're too busy being addicted to screens and not living in the real world, but living in a virtual world. So I think that's also part of the mental health breakdown amongst youth today. And of course, the pandemic had a major impact, wearing masks all the time. I know, you know, seeing people wear masks everywhere freaks me out. Used to freak me out when I first saw it, still freaks me out today. So anyways, we're going to play this interview that Alex Smith from Radio EcoShock did with eco-anxiety expert Dr. Britt Ray, who is the author of Generation Dread, Finding Purpose in an Age of Climate Crisis. Here is that interview now.
You know damaging climate change is just starting to roll. How do kids and young people handle that? Journalist, author, and academic Britt Ray is here to tell us with her new book, Generation Dread, Finding Purpose in an Age of Climate Crisis. Dr. Ray is a Canadian transplanted to Stanford University and the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. She is a postdoctoral fellow investigating the mental health consequences of ecological disruption. You may be dealing with those impacts. Today's youth certainly are. From California, Britt Ray, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you so much. It's good to be here.
Who is Generation Dread and what defines them?
Generation Dread, as I explore it in the book, is really anyone, despite their age, who is able right now to feel a sense of distress based on their awareness and experience of negative environmental change and impending climate crises that are turning into quite a disruptive future that we have to contend with. So I don't mean to only isolate the young people with that title, although I do make the case, based on very compelling data that we have, that this distress disproportionately affects younger folks among us, so Gen Z, millennials. And this makes sense, of course. The climate crisis is something that they've been aware of for basically their entire lives. The fact that they have unfairly and unjustly inherited it, along with the duty to clean it up, this is a very difficult truth to contend with, especially long before you have the opportunity to go out into the world, vote in order to uphold power, to try and change systems that would address the threat. And, you know, typically this is something that young people understand before they can go out and explore important aspects of their identity. So it becomes quite crushing in terms of the anxiety and the anger and the grief. One thing that has emerged in recent years as a tagline for all this is eco-anxiety, which the American Psychological Association defines as the chronic fear of environmental doom. And those of us who are researching it argue that it's more than just anxiety. It's really this umbrella of feelings, many co-occurring challenging emotions, like what I mentioned, grief, anger, maybe a sense also of helplessness or powerlessness, things that rob us of agency to be able to face how daunting this is. And so the difficult emotions need tending to in order to help people live with them better and cope, but also use them adaptively and constructively to be able to take collective action, because we have a lot of harm to still reduce, and it is not too late. When it comes to young people, why I say we know that they are really impacted by this, one study that my colleagues and I did last year looked at climate anxiety, its scope and burden in 10,000 young people around the world. So they are 16 to 25 years old, and we were surveying people in the Philippines and India and Nigeria, but also places like Finland and France and the U.S. and some other nations. And we found that of these global respondents, 45% said that their feelings about the climate crisis are negatively impacting their daily functioning, so disrupting their ability to eat, sleep, concentrate, go to school, go to work, be in relationship, play, have fun, very normal things for young people to be able to access. 75% said that the future is frightening, and 56% said that they feel that humanity is doomed. And all these are incredibly sad statistics to really take in about how young people are walking around and feeling. You know, 39% of them said that the climate crisis makes them hesitant to have their own children. And importantly, we found that these heavy feelings are tightly correlated with young people's sense of being betrayed by governments and lied to by leaders, introducing this concept of institutional betrayal and the psychological injury that can occur when people with less power rely on those with more power to protect them, and they fail to uphold that responsibility. So Generation Dread is any and all of us who are feeling these forms of distress about the climate and wider ecological crisis, but we need to pay particular attention to the way that it's affecting young people all over the world, as I mentioned, in some lower and middle income nations with higher hazard or exposure in the climate crisis, as well as high income nations. It's something we can see everywhere.
Well, those are terrible statistics for young people. I do know that the baby boomers grew up knowing their city could be incinerated at any moment by an exchange of nuclear weapons, and we were trained to dive under desks or jump into a ditch if a big flash announced the atomic bomb had arrived. How is that different from the stress young people are growing up through today?
There are certainly some important overlaps and similarities with that kind of existential stress between heightened nuclear threat and the climate crisis, and some key differences. So when it comes to nuclear annihilation, of course, there is a true helplessness at play, because whether a foreign leader drops a bomb on you suddenly, there's really not much that you can do. You're totally exposed. It's extremely unjust, and living with that waking fear is incredibly existentially difficult, and has been for young people, of course, through time, as you mentioned, who had to do duck and cover drills under their desks. It has produced this psychic numbing effect in both crises, where that helplessness one feels under, you know, potential nuclear annihilation, and the helplessness we tend to feel in the face of the climate crisis because of how overarching the threat is somewhat similar. However, the threat of the climate crisis is extremely different than the nuclear threat in that it requires action from all of us, because we're not talking about detonate, do or don't. We're talking about the fabric of our world and every single choice that goes into the way that we are living day in, day out by burning more fossil fuels. We have a lot of agency in this crisis as compared with the nuclear example, because we've known about it for decades and we've had opportunities to deploy solutions and have been forgoing that for a variety of perverse reasons bound up in power and politics. However, we still are on this, you know, moving escalator here. Yes, it's kind of going downwards, but we can do things to turn around and crawl up the escalator before we hit the bottom floor. And so this idea of the helplessness we feel is a sham in comparison with nuclear threat. We have a lot of things we can do together to address this at any moment. We have to, you know, have changes to affect our world and how we're living. So basically, there is a similar impact on how people are psychologically responding, which can produce some apathy, or, you know, it's actually not that people don't care. It's rather just that it's anxiety-inducing, and it makes people feel uncomfortable when they see their own complicity with holding up high-emitting systems. And yet, there's lots we can do. So it's really about what's required of us as individuals at this time that makes the climate threat different and complicated in our psychological response as compared with just being subjected to a nuclear attack.
You got your doctorate in communications at the University of Copenhagen, and you were moving along in a direction, and then something seems to have turned you toward this new, brand new field, really, about eco-anxiety and the impacts of knowing about climate change and the other ecological problems. What drove you into that new direction?
Yeah, so I was just wrapping up my PhD when I had a profound experience with eco-anxiety and grief about how dangerous the climate crisis now is and what we have to deal with going forward. It really occurred when my partner and I in 2017 started talking seriously about trying to get pregnant. And as a science communicator, ingesting all of these climate reports and squaring them with the lack of effective action from our political leadership, I could not move into that decision easily. It birthed a painful dilemma, and I had a hard time wrapping my head around whether or not I felt comfortable doing this. Was it still wise to have a child? Was it a compassionate thing to do to bring a person into a situation where they're going to have to deal with climate breakdown for the rest of their lives? Of course, with a lot of uncertainty around how bad it's going to get and how nations will respond and when. And so that forced me to confront some ecologically linked emotions that I hadn't had to before on such a deep level. And I became troubled because it was difficult, but also fascinated by this. And I thought, okay, if I'm having this intense psychological response to my awareness of the climate crisis at this stage, what does it mean for other people? What are all the other ways in which folks who are different from me are being affected, you know, psychosocially, on a deeper spiritual level? And I thought, this is something that is rather underexplored. I wonder if I can do the research enough to see if this is substantial enough to write a book on. So I made a one-hour radio program for the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation in this area. I discovered I had just touched the tip of the iceberg. There was so much more to explore. And I started doing my research, Generation Dread, in order to understand the more manifold, widespread mental health impacts of the climate crisis. Importantly, to be able to describe the problem, but then push through to the other side of grasping the solutions that we have, the approaches for resilience building and getting our communities prepared in order to move through all these changes in an adaptive way that brings strength and protections for people's mental health and emotional.
We will get back to the things that we could do. I wonder, climate disruption is so huge. It reaches species everywhere. Yet even without greenhouse gases, human-made plastics and toxic chemicals spread from the Himalayas to the deepest ocean trench. Humans slash down forests. We kill things off. Is it a mistake to bundle all that into the label climate change?
So the way that I bring those connections forth in the book is by using the frame of the planetary health crisis. I find it much more useful than going down the individual tunnels of each anthropogenic violent impact on the environment that we have. And what this framing articulates is how the human project has outstripped the planet's capacity to support our lifestyles in such a way that we're seeing it in terms of water scarcity, in terms of vector-borne diseases, chronic diseases from air pollution, climate change and dangerous disasters, the biodiversity crisis, you know, the pandemic. All of these things share the same root cause, which is how humans dominate the natural world and extract from it in ways that are now presenting humanity with the number one threat to our shared human health. So it's really outlining the public health argument and trying to quantify these costs to human health based on how our behaviors have been pillaging the environment for a long time. It's now, you know, accumulating in these negative ways that we ought to pay attention to. It's effective at not only drawing the connections between microplastics and the climate crisis, for example, but also being able to say why we need to do something about it, because for many decades of environmental campaigning, telling people to care about polar bears has not been working, for example. And this really gets the teeth into the self-interest of humans who want to be able to protect their health.
In the book, you introduce us to Earth Emotions, Glenn Albrecht, and his concept of solastalgia. What is that?
Solastalgia is a term that Glenn Albrecht came up with to describe the homesickness a person can have when they are still at home because the environment has changed so much in that place of home that it's no longer recognizable, and therefore you can't access the solace that you once did there. He had this feeling when first looking out upon some rolling hills in Western Australia that he played in as a child, but when returning some years later, saw that it had been transformed into open tar pit mining. And he was struck with such a sense of loss and sadness, but importantly, this mixture of nostalgia and the missing of the solace that the place once gave him, which forced him to come up with this portmanteau to be able to describe what it was that he was feeling. And it's been interesting because while he came up with that term many years ago, I believe around 2010 or so, it has since been shared with many communities around the world who say, yes, this is exactly what we feel. This is what is going on as our landscapes erode, as our livelihoods are no longer things that we can uphold because we can't fish here anymore, for example, or we can't traipse along the ice because it's melting to do what our ancestors have for thousands of years, or because this coastline we call home is being lost with erosion and sea level rise. And so it's really struck a chord with many people that, yes, it's grief and it's worry about what's happening, but it's also just this deep sense of loss of the comfort and solace that place-based relationships give us.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with our guest, Dr. Britt Ray. Her new book is Generation Dread, Finding Purpose in an Age of Climate Crisis. Your book takes a three-step approach. We become aware of humanity's dangerous direction first, and then that's followed by an emotional reaction, and then hopefully a transition into activism or a purpose. Does everyone follow this path? Or can some people go straight from ecological awareness right into activism without suffering through the feeling stage?
Certainly, people have their own pathways, and not everyone hits each step in the same order. I try to highlight the importance of feeling all of the challenging emotions that arise with understanding that our connections that we hold dear in the world are being disintegrated, and our life support systems are naturally, when disintegrating, going to produce a difficult environmental impact within us because it shows that we care and that we are wakeful to what's happening, and it's really a compassionate and humane approach because we want to uphold the health of life support systems and other species and vulnerable communities. And so being able to acknowledge that and let the feelings be there sounds simple, actually very hard for a lot of people to do. A lot of people have not been welcomed into a space of inviting negative emotions as important information, being able to integrate them without self-judgment or shame, especially coming off of many years of kind of neoliberal thinking and progress and toxic positivity and things that would easily produce some shame around feeling difficult things. Then understanding we can do things to transform these emotions within ourselves and work on psychosocial and emotional resilience building skills. There's kind of an internal activism toolkit to make people deal with the fact that it's hard to have your eyes open to the problem and work on this issue. You can easily fall into spaces of burnout because it demands endless energy from you and you still might feel like you're not making a dent. We need to be able to do things to support ourselves individually inside and then also come together with others and take those transformative actions to change the world itself, which is, of course, the main intervention we need to feel better. We need climate action in order to feel better about this entire crisis. However, what you point out is that some people, again, because of this kind of cultural of belittlement we live in, or an aversion to difficult emotions, fear that if we let them in, we'll just kind of be subsumed by them, can try to offset the emergence of distress into the sentence we've heard again and again through time that action is the antidote to despair. And so instead of letting the feelings be there, can just offset them immediately and then roll their sleeves up and get to acting, which is great. Of course, we need much more action and it's super urgent. And so all that is productive as long as you're also doing what's needed to support the existential feelings, because this crisis is basically ripping away people's ontological security, a sense of order and continuity in their life, which can have a lot of behavioral impacts if not cared for, because these are scary truths that we have to deal with, and we'd rather, you know, many people show us, we'd rather avoid them, turn away, stick our heads in the sand. And so whether we consciously approve of this going on within us or not, like, these feelings will be under the surface, and they can pop up and produce maladaptive coping if we're not paying attention to them, or cause us to snap and burn out when they do emerge. So I try to encourage people to, through the book and through the writing and knowledge of climate-aware therapists like Caroline Hickman, really argue for an inside-out approach to activism that doesn't offset all the distress just into internal action, with the expectation that that'll take away all the pain and you'll just be fine, because we're in a battle of many losses here, and we know we're going to have to continue to bear witness to struggle, to loss of human life, to loss of species, to loss of wild places, as we continue to do what we can to save what we can. All of that is really hard on a person, and so that's why I, you know, hope to provide examples for people who don't take that middle step to validate why they might want to. And then there's others who also don't take the action, right? They might just get lost in the emotions and actually fall into a crevice and get trapped in a pit of despair, which can breed a sense of fatalism or this inaccurate belief that it's too late to make any difference, which kind of narratively forecloses the future. People, especially if dealing with these thoughts and feelings on their own and not having them be interrupted and supported by others who can validate them and share the feelings with them, are more subject to be able to more authentically connect with a feeling of doom, which of course becomes its own self-fulfilling prophecy if there's no kind of robust sense of being able to make a change, make a difference that matters, and make meaning from all of this distress. So it kind of goes both ways, and there's no guarantee about the path that a person might take. But what I've learned from my own research and my own exploration with these emotions is that it's really key to not think either or, but think both and. The action is both internal and external.
Britt, are there common emotions you find in your study of mental impacts, like keystones or signals of ecological anxiety?
So, yeah, I mean, people could have their sleep disrupted often, nightmares, visions. Several people I interviewed in my book discussed having these kind of visceral visions, daydreams of finding themselves in the midst of a climate disaster, walking down a New York City bustling street and seeing floodwaters rushing up, for example, even though it wasn't happening, but they would feel as though it was happening, or needing to run with their child from basically war over dwindling resources because of climate calamity, and having them witness their child die, or having their child witness their parents die. These kinds of horrific visions that people would be stuck in because of their climate anxieties interrupting the way that they were just seeing their day-to-day world, or just a general lack of concentration, inability to stop talking about their climate fears and really find balance and be able to explore the other joyful, nourishing things that are also true about life, or maybe feeling the really urgent need to do something super efficiently all of a sudden, like recycle, or, you know, no longer being able to be in relationship with people who don't care about the climate emergency, just becoming super intolerable to have to share space with maybe parents or friends or partners who disregard and disavow the importance. All of this becomes too painful for a person in acute climate distress, and so they'll drop those relationships. Changing behaviors in other ways, maybe refusing to have children, refusing to ever fly again, these sorts of things. There's lots of different ways it can show up.
I'm not sure refusing to ever fly again is definitely climate anxiety. I mean, Kevin Anderson of the Tyndall Center has promised never to fly again, but he's doing it pretty rationally as a scientist, saying, I just don't want to add to those emissions up there.
Oh, yeah. It doesn't mean that it is the cause of all people's decisions not to fly, but climate anxiety can be a way in which someone comes to that decision. And also, climate anxiety is rational. It's not that this is an irrational issue or a pathology or some kind of disorder that a person has within themselves. It's them being awoken to how severe the threat is. Of course, it can become unhelpfully strong, and a person can take it on too seriously within their own life, and it starts to disrupt their emotions in ways that require professional support. Some of those examples I gave you are really extreme examples of how it shows up in a person's life. They're not meant to describe everyone who could self-assess as climate anxious. But what mental health professionals argue is that this is not in the DSM, and it's important that it stays out because this is not something you can get a diagnosis for due to the fact that it is a healthy response to a very real unfolding civilizational threat, and we ought to feel these things. In fact, it's a bit more worrying to think about those who don't feel any distress about what's going on because they're still able to deploy such strong psychological defenses to it, which are not helpful for creating the action that's needed. So not to at all take away from Dr. Kevin Anderson's rational thinking there. He could do it just from looking at the data and understand it very well without feeling anxiety, but also it's the kind of impact that can help ease some people's anxiety when they see that, hey, I'm getting really distressed about what's going on. My environmental values are way over here, but I'm gesturing with my left hand far out to the left, but I'm seeing my actions are way over here gesturing to the right. And that big gap between my values and my actions is causing me psychological discomfort. I can make some decisions in order to close that gap, make it more narrow, and that'll bring me a bit more comfort.
I note that science was originally developed almost exclusively by men, and one of its rules is keep emotions out of science. It's like there's no crying in science. You just are supposed to stick to the facts. Is that line being crossed now, and does it really need to be crossed when we're dealing with this kind of information?
Yeah, it's not working anymore to keep the emotions out of the science. It is becoming too mentally exhausting for many people working in these fields of conservation biology, climate science, and other kinds of environmentally focused professions to bear witness to what the data shows, what the observations make completely clear, and worse, understanding how much harder it's going to get because of the lack of action and denial of how serious this has been over time. And so it becomes just overwhelming in the sense that some professionals quit in order to get some relief. It is too much. And these are emotions that they're contending with. It's the burnout of having to exist in this system that is not deploying the solutions we've had at our fingertips. And while yes, there's a lot of collegial concern in science that if your colleagues see you acting in a certain way that applies emotional cadence or communication, you know, expression to what you're doing, that you're going to get judged as not being a good scientist, you're not being an objective scientist. But that really upholds this taboo in our culture, which says that scientists can't be working from empirical data and simultaneously be full humans who have emotions about what they know. That is just not what it means to be human. People have both. We must stop this damaging, you know, expectation that people can kind of bifurcate themselves into just being rational, empirical measurement machines or those who are irrational and somehow dangerous because they have emotional responses to stuff. That's not how humans work, and that's a very kind of outdated and Cartesian approach to things. So there are increasingly more scientists coming out to bravely say, enough is enough. Like, we need to take a stand. We have tried to protect our data throughout decades so that we don't come off as activists, we don't speak with a whiff of emotion in order that we're not going to be disregarded by policymakers, for example, as being on the side of climate disaster, let's say, so that they won't listen to what we are trying to impress upon them, and therefore we're trying to protect our data so it can actually affect policy change. That all makes sense, but at this late stage in the day with the stakes this high, the polytest, the, you know, professional etiquette is not sufficient for the task at hand. Because it isn't expressing the urgency and it isn't making the dire nature of this clear. And truth be told, many scientists have these emotions. So, you know, being able to confront them can help people move through them without burning out and needing to quit out of feeling just so demotivated by a culture that really isn't listening and taking these scientists' empirical knowledge seriously.
Can you give us a couple of quick hints or snapshots of the advice that you might offer listeners to get from climate anxiety into a more purposeful action or meaning for our lives?
It's really important to step out of isolation in these thoughts and feelings. We don't have social norms around how to process this stuff still. It's kind of disenfranchised grief, the kind of grief that is not typically recognized. which people will be familiar with around cases of suicide, abortion, miscarriage, that sort of a thing where it's awkward and difficult to raise with others because of this lack of normalization. Same with, you know, being really overwhelmed with glacier melt, permafrost thaw, communities experiencing drought-induced starvation right now, what have you, because of the climate crisis. And so we need to be able to find ways to speak about these things with others, because we say a lot when we say nothing at all. We say that something doesn't matter by neglect of talking about it. So talking about it makes it matter, but importantly, finding others who can validate and support the feelings and legitimize them and won't say, don't be so dire, you're fine, or you're just being dramatic, which can happen to people and absolutely does not help if they feel, you know, that they're having their concerns minimized in that way. And increasingly, there are specific containing settings, so groups and programs that are arising, especially in just the last handful of years, to give people these spaces where they know they can meet people who will give permission to the feelings and mirror them, and then they can start to feel more at ease and in good company. So something like the Good Grief Network, which runs a 10-step program based on Alcoholics Anonymous for moving people through climate distress to meaningful actions at this time. It's a way of reinvesting the energy that one has lost from being so stressed out into purpose and action in ways that will stick, because you're led on a journey to author your amount of change and action taking yourself and what that looks like. Or something like Climate Awakening, which are these virtual drop-in sessions where people can have open-hearted conversations online with others 3 times a week to get that containment for the emotions, or something like the All We Can Save circles or climate cafes, which are decentralized meetings that do similar things. I mean, it says something about where we're at as a culture that all of these resources are cropping up. It's like a cottage industry of support tools. But then, you know, importantly, it is really key that one can let the distress and the despair and the hopelessness and the helplessness or whatever it is that one might be feeling, let it be there and actually lean towards it, because the only way out of this is through. We can't avoid these feelings, and they're totally legitimate. And the key is to not get stuck in any one dire place with them. So to learn to harness them requires movement and being open enough to get curious about these feelings and lean into them. We know this from a lot of interventions for dealing with anxiety and depression and other forms of distress, too. This can be really helpful. It allows the permission, that removes the judgment, and then valuing these feelings and having them teach you things as you feel them can really kind of whack away the distractions in life that might otherwise be clogging your sphere, and can point out some existential meaning within you about, okay, let's reassess the situation here. Let's like really own up to the severity of the predicament. And then you can engage in what's called meaning-focused coping, which says I can express my existential goals, values, and beliefs and seek forms of connection and communication that allow me to tap into what I find most existentially meaningful. And that process can bring people into ways of being at this time that will make them feel much better, because they know that they're making meaning from the distress and, you know, in whatever way they want to, addressing this issue. So there's many more coping ideas than that, but those are some broad strokes that I've seen transform a lot of people who have been otherwise trapped in some pretty dark places when contemplating the climate and ecological crisis, and then they end up feeling far less plagued by the feelings and far more useful, and can really step into some empowerment and agency and know that they can tolerate difficult things while also working towards a better future.
That's great, great resources. As we wrap up here, how do listeners connect with you and your newsletter, Jen Dredd?
Oh, thank you. So Jen Dredd, the newsletter, is free. It's at jendredd.substack.com. You can also find me on Instagram at jen_dredd, or on Twitter at Britt Ray with 2 T's, BRITTWRAY. And then my new book, Generation Dredd, is out in anywhere you can get books now.
We've been speaking with Dr. Britt Ray from Stanford and the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine Center on climate change and planetary health, and that's really what she's about. You can get more tips to follow up in my blog at ecoshock.org, or just go to brittray.com. Britt, thank you for helping us out on Radio EcoShock.
Thank you so much for having me, Alex. Good to talk with you.
I'm Alex Smith.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio. for the world.
And that was Alex Smith's interview with Dr. Britt Ray, who is the author of Generation Dread, Finding Purpose in an Age of Climate Crisis. And you can find out more about Radio EcoShock, which is where that interview came from, by going to their website, ecoshock.org. And Dr. Ray also has her own website, which is brittray.com. And Britt is spelled B-R-I-T-T, and Ray is spelled W-R-A-Y. You are listening to Ecolibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. We're basically out of time, so we're going to let you know that you can always email us anytime at ecolibrium@ckut.ca with any comments or questions or suggestions. You can follow us on Facebook, although we're not too active on Facebook, but we are there, facebook.com/EcolibriumCKUTMontreal. We have an affiliated podcast on Spotify called the Ecolibrium Radio Podcast, and we have a little website with a link to our SoundCloud page where there are some other interviews you can listen to with people like Farley Mowat or David Suzuki, and that's at ecolibriumradio.weebly.com. Thanks so much for listening. We're going to leave you with some music. And we're going to leave you with the tune Red Ant, in brackets, Nature, by Olu Dara. And this is from his Neighborhoods album, which came out in 2001. So enjoy that. Thanks for listening to Ecolibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM.
Junior, mama call you.
He out there with them ants again.
So he claim he can talk to him.
Pat, go out there and get your brother.
Back. Mm.
Hey, hey, hey. I saw a red ant crying. Cause the black ant was walking on his heels. Saw a black ant crying. Cause the white ant was trying to steal. Saw a white ant crying, yeah, cause nature refused to pay his bill. But nature cries too. But nature cries too. Don't stop me crying. Y'all don't want to see me cry. Y'all going to dinner. All three of y'all go together. They all went together. When they finished eating, when they finished eating, was the one happy fella. Nature cries too. He went back to crying again. Nature said, Mr. Black and Nature said, Mr. White and Nature said, you made your own bed, you make your own bed. I gave you everything, gave you everything, gave you everything I could. Nature, cause nature cries too. I cry up a hurricane. I'll cry up a tornado. Don't stop me crying, cause I'll send you El Nino. Nature said, Mr. Red Ant, got gold up in them mountains, yeah. Nature, won't y'all dance? Dance, dance. White ant was trying to steal. Saw a white ant crying, crying, crying.
Cinema Politica is thrilled to announce the theatrical release of Dear Jackie, a feature documentary by Henri Pardot. The film opens on June 17 in 4 theaters in Montreal: Cinéma Public, Cinéma du Musée, Cinémathèque Québécoise, and Cinéma Moderne, with the director and special guest in attendance at select screenings. Dear Jackie poetically tells the story of one of the oldest black communities in Canada, Montreal's Little Burgundy, by way of a cinematic letter to Jackie Robinson, the first black man to break the color barrier in professional baseball. It also masterfully connects history to the present by challenging the myth of a post-racial society. This release is co-presented by Desta Black Youth Network, Tyndale St. George's Community Center, Canteen Bergs, and Makisia Solo. For more information and tickets, visit cinemapolitica.org. We hope to see you there. This is a CKUT co-presentation.
Through Tree Canada's National Greening Program, native tree seedlings are planted across Canada, creating a widespread impact. Planted trees provide habitat, prevent soil erosion, and reforest areas that have suffered tree loss due to pests and weather. Tree Canada performs 1, 2, and 5-year assessments to monitor tree survival and ensure the trees planted are on track to meet the forest cover goals of the site. To learn more or to get involved, go to treecanada.ca.
What time?